absolutely. Living life is very scary. You don't know what lies in front of you at every moment. And one of the ways we align ourselves in life is by talking to other people, finding out what their experience in the same situation has been. The literature of this is simply an extension, a refinement, a higher version of the kind of thing we do in normal life all the time.
Literary critic and biographer Phyllis Rose. She's here to talk about the literature of women's lives. Welcome to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Major funding for this edition of Soundings comes from the Modern Language Association of America, which encourages the teaching and study of languages and literature. It's been quite a time coming, but there's no doubt that the literature of women's lives has firmly established itself as a powerful force in popular as well as academic culture in contemporary American life. The causes for this are still open to debate, ranging from the women's movement and feminism to changing patterns in labor and education. But according to one leading observer, the evidence of effects is indisputable. Phyllis Rose is an essayist, biographer, and literary critic who teaches at Wesleyan University. She says that in its richness of experience and expression, including autobiographies, journals, and memoirs, the literature of women's lives embraces the perspectives of writers as different and diverse as Anne Frank, Virginia Woolf, and Joan Didion. Phyllis Rose is the editor of the Norton Book of Women's Lives.
The literature of women's lives is memoirs, diaries, autobiographies written by women. Books, essays in which women talk about the material of their own lives. It's my belief that women are especially good at this kind of thing and that the literature of women's lives is one of the glories of women's literature.
Uh-huh. Why are they particularly good at it?
Well, I think that people do well what they do a lot, and women, for one reason or another, are encouraged to track their daily lives. First of all, women are, in general, in charge of households. They have to keep track of where the children are, whether the cupboard is full. They have to get the ironing done. They have to run the household on a daily basis. This works against abstraction. This works in favor of particularity, an attention to incident, an attention to anecdote. Then, of course, we know that women, for one reason or another, gossip more than men do. They discuss with their friends the events of their daily life. I also think that it's part of female culture to share experience in a way that is not true, perhaps, for men. I think that in male autobiography, the buried model is of the man who has accomplished a great deal and wants to tell you about it. Uh-huh. In female autobiography, I think the buried model is more the woman who is confiding to a friend or helping a younger woman to live her life better by sharing the secrets of her own.
Fair enough. What forms do these expressions take? I mean, I'm thinking of, memoir, biography, autobiography, and then we have poems and novels. How about that?
Diaries are the most primitive form of the literature of women's lives. That would be a daily record, and it can be very simple, very bare bones. Uh-huh. Did the ironing today. If you read the pioneer diaries, 19th century pioneer diaries, they're very utilitarian. They get more complex, more inward, but they needn't be one or the other. Perhaps the greatest diary of the 20th century is the Diary of Anne Frank, which records the captivity of a Jewish girl in Holland trying to escape from the Nazis, and there's nothing primitive about that. That is simply a literary masterpiece. I would say that the next step up from diary is autobiography, which is an attempt by the writer to describe the whole course of her life.
Mm-hmm.
And I would distinguish between autobiography and memoir, although I must say this is very personal, this distinction. Memoir, to me, is more focused, narrower. For an example, I would give Vivian Gornick's Fierce Attachments, which is just about her relationship with her mother. Uh-huh. So it focuses on that attachment. A memoir could also focus on a year or a particular time, for example, Marguerite Duras's book, The War.
Phyllis, you have said that if Holden Caulfield was the sort of literary model for young men, and I suppose for many young women in the 1950s, the female model, on the other hand, would be, as you have just cited here, Anne Frank. Tell me about that sort of arc or interplay between these two narrators who are telling us about their lives.
Yes, Anne Frank is the Anne Frank the book is a valuable book because it tells us about victims of the Holocaust, but it's also been an enormously popular book because it tells us about the experience of being a female teenager about mm-hmm. as well as it has ever been done. Mm-hmm. And I, for example, growing up in the 50s, that book came out in 1952, responded very personally to the Diary of Anne Frank. I thought, now, finally, somebody is talking about what my life is like. Now, it's weird to say my life is like the life of a girl who has never been outside one room for 2 years, a girl who is in fear of death constantly. Uh-huh. But in some ways, there was a connection between me as a teenager in my privileged white middle-class suburb of New York and Anne Frank in her garret.
Apart from the horrific circumstances surrounding this young woman, just the act of telling her life is something that touched you.
I think that she set off this tremendous energy of the latter part of the 20th century that's been devoted to autobiographical writing in women. She set an example. She was just a little girl, and she picked up her pen and wrote herself into immortality. Right. And I think that there were many little girls around America and the rest of the world who took heart from her example.
You have said that until, roughly 40, 50 years ago, there really weren't many memoiristic or autobiographical models that women would look to when we speak of the literature of women's
lives. I remember absolutely being a little girl, being about 7 or 8 years old, whatever age it is that you suddenly realize that you're not going to grow up to be a cowboy, that you're going to grow up to be a woman. And first, I was horrified, and I thought, well, being a very scholarly little girl, I thought I'd better look into this. So I went down to my local library to see what was in store for me.
And what'd you find?
Well, I found Helen Keller, Eleanor Roosevelt, and the Duchess of Windsor.
Uh-huh. And your mom had a great line about that book.
Because I didn't want to be Helen Keller, and I didn't really want to be Eleanor Roosevelt. I thought of the three of them, the Duchess was the most exciting. So I checked her out of the library, and I brought her home, and my mother said, I really shouldn't read the book, that the Duchess was not a worthy model. She said, what did that woman ever do except marry somebody she shouldn't?
Now, how has that picture changed, Phyllis, over the past 40 or 50 years? I mean, we look around now, for example, your own work, the Norton Book of Women's Lives, there is an enormously rich field to be harvested. And you look back 50 years and there were only the seeds there, I take it.
It's changed happily, enormously. There is so much out there. Uh-huh. One time I remember being at the airport and looking at what was for sale in the airport bookstore, and this was not a representative sample, but half the books were women's autobiographies or memoirs. It's become an enormous category. We are very interested in the personal, confession. As a culture, we like to hear people telling the truth about their own lives. So it's become an enormously popular category of literature.
Let me argue with you and be contentious for a moment. What makes it literature? There is the argument to be advanced that the commonplace, the everyday, the ordinary, the mundane, is not worthy of what historically, traditionally, we call literature. I take it that you are going to tell me that there is something here of literary merit, artistic content, as well as these personal stories at work.
Potentially, absolutely. I mean, I absolutely believe that everybody's life could be an autobiography, could be a memoir. I think everybody should be encouraged to keep journals. I think everybody should be encouraged to write memoirs and autobiographies. I think it's a good thing for the writer.
What makes it literature? That's my question.
Literature is what touches other people and allows other people to share your experience. Now, to do that, you have to be a good writer. And a good writer is not necessarily a professional writer. Many of the selections that I put in my book are not by professional writers, but they're by women who have been touched for one reason or another by the desire, the patience, the scrupulousness to create a great literary work.
You say, for example, that literacy itself is not necessarily a
absolutely
component.
True. Literacy itself is not necessary. I have two women in that book who are pre-literate. The best, my best example is Nisa, who was a nomadic tribeswoman in the Kalahari Desert in Africa. And she collaborated with an American anthropologist named Marjorie Shostak on the story of her life. Now, not every woman in that tribe was capable of collaborating to tell the story of her life. Not everybody had the necessary perspective. Not everybody had the interest in doing the work.
Right.
Not everybody had the language. She was unique. You know, there were people, Shostak would ask the question to all the women, tell me what your parents did for you. And one woman answered, my parents fed me and I grew, and that's what my parents did. Well, this is not going to make a very interesting book.
Like a shopping list.
Yeah, right. The most people approach experience too abstractly. They're not prepared to get down into the detail. They don't have the patience to tell the story at the length that it needs.
Mm-hmm.
So even a storyteller who doesn't write has to have literary talent.
Let's talk about some of the exemplars of what you call the literature of women's lives, again, over the past 40 or 50 years. Phyllis, you talk about writers like Mary McCarthy and Joan Didion. Again, we have this wide panoply of people to look at. Why, for example, is McCarthy important?
Well, she's important to me. When I was growing up in the 50s, every woman's autobiography or memoir that was published was a personal gift to me. There were so few of them that I thought it was amazing when one was published. And I think before Mary McCarthy, the only major one, in addition to the Diary of Anne Frank, was Simone de Beauvoir, her Memoirs of a Dutiful Daughter, which was a revelation. Just its title was a revelation. The idea that you could start out being a dutiful daughter, which is what I was,
right,
and end up a famous philosopher was extremely exciting.
Now, one of the elements that ties her work together, according to several scholars that I have talked to and interviewed, is liberation. We're talking about Simone de Beauvoir. Why is she important in the literature of women's lives, representing that? That's a very simple word, and yet it implies an enormous amount, does it not?
She broke loose. She came from a conservative, upper middle class French family, and she managed to get away from the life that her parents would have thrust upon her to create her own life.
Uh-huh.
I think that a lot of these stories are stories of liberation, the opposite of the captivity narrative, which was such a classic in American literature of the 19th century.
Now, how does Simone de Beauvoir come to us in the 1990s? I mean, who are her inheritors, and who are the people, the women creating literature these days who are carrying on that tradition, that idea?
A direct inheritor, Simone de Beauvoir, in a sense, is the mother of the entire tradition. Every single one of them is owes a debt to Simone de Beauvoir.
And yet there are departures from that tradition. There are people who have come along and qualified it, done things to it. Who would some of those be?
Well, in the way I see the body of work, there are different schools. And I would say that one very important school in the literature of women's lives is what I call the literature of obscurity. I would give as an important date there, 1970, which was the year that the women's movement really got off the ground and the year that the civil rights movement began to have a tremendous impact on American culture.
Now, you mean people who are moving from what was then obscurity into a sort of literary
exactly.
light?
Exactly. These are people outside the mainstream of the then mainstream of American culture, and to start hearing their life stories was quite stunning, I think, and changed, of course, what we think of as the mainstream of American culture. I'm thinking of a book like Maya Angelou's mm-hmm. I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, or Ann Moody's Coming of Age in Mississippi, which is about a young black woman participating in the historic sit-ins mm-hmm. of the South in
does,
the 60s.
Does race have a special bearing here when we speak of the literature of women's lives? It's an enriching element, but it's not necessarily a unique qualifier. Am I right?
I think that the African-American tradition has encouraged personal narratives for one reason or another. So I think that it's a particularly rich body of work, both by men and women. Man-Child in the Promised Land by mm-hmm. Claude Brown, by a man, and the autobiography of Malcolm X were other great works of the early 70s.
Phyllis Rose, we're talking about the literature of women's lives. What do you mean by the literature of revelation? What is that all about?
Well, the literature of revelation is the name that I give to a body of work associated with Bloomsbury and those writers in England in the 1920s who were especially interested in memoir. They had something called the Memoir Club, and they uh-huh. would write, men and women would write memoirs. Most of them kept diaries. They believed that sharing the secrets of their own life, sharing the materials of their own life, was an important political act almost.
All right. Now, Virginia Woolf is a key figure in this configuration, and I want you to talk to our listeners about Virginia Woolf, but at the same time, I want you to answer another question. Can you go too far with this stuff of, you know, sort of spilling your guts on the page and all of the intimate details of your life? When does autobiography and memoir stop, and therapy and self-help and the agony of revelation begin?
Well, I am not talking about kiss and tell literature. I don't think that anybody cares
Fair
anymore
enough.
Who Virginia Woolf slept with or didn't. That's not what the literature of revelation is. It's really quite high-minded, I might say.
Fair enough.
Now, as for therapy, it's very unlikely that any readers would be troubled by books that were merely therapeutic. The circumstances of publishing these days are such that a book that is just therapeutic is not going to be published. If a book is written for therapy, so much the better for the writer, as long as nobody else has to read it. I think it's a very good way for people to spend their time. It's very low cost, harmless, uh-huh. and as I say, unless I have to read it, it doesn't hurt anybody else.
Well, then what in fact makes Virginia Woolf and the Bloomsbury Group worth reading when we get into this this literature of revelation? What's the nub of it there?
You happen to have picked on one of my favorite practitioners
well,
of
you wrote
literature.
Well, you wrote a book about her.
That's right. And the diary of Virginia Woolf is a book that I go back to over and over and find inspiration in, not because she preaches any messages. She really doesn't. But because she brings such an intelligence, so much vitality, so much art to the observation of her daily life, that it kind of shakes me up and reminds me that I have to bring energy to the act of daily living and of observing and appreciating and savoring my daily life. Let me mention another writer in the Bloomsbury Group, V. Sackville West, who wrote a diary, which then was used by her son Nigel Nicholson in his book about his parents' marriage called Portrait of a Marriage. Mm-hmm. She kept a diary of her affair with another woman, and she did it intending that it be published because she herself had suffered so much from the isolation of being bisexual and not knowing anybody else who was, that she wanted to make it easier for other people.
Well, now here's a topic, bisexuality, that is in and of itself is unusual, some would say scandalous, sensational. The object underlying this is what? The sort of teaching other people how to live a life.
Exactly.
In particular circumstances that may or may not connect with another particular reader. I take it that this is one of the threads that draws all of this together when we speak of the literature of women's lives.
Absolutely. Living life is very scary. You don't know what lies in front of you at every moment. Uh-huh. And one of the ways we align ourselves in life is by talking to other people, finding out what their experience in the same situation has been. The literature of this is simply an extension, a refinement, a higher version of the kind of thing we do in normal life all the time.
Phyllis, you're talking here about the literature of women's lives and the Bloomsbury Group. Let me present you with another example, an American writer, Joan Didion. Now, she seems to me to be kind of tough and cold and personal. Why would I want to read her to find out how to live a life?
I wouldn't say that you should read Joan Didion to find out how to live life. I think that she is important in this developing story of the literature of women's lives for another reason. She was basically a historian, a journalist, an observer, but what she did was introduce elements of her own life into the narrative. She would talk about herself. She would tell you what she was doing at the moment when she observed whatever it was that she observed. She would tell you about the state of her marriage. She was a practitioner of the new journalism, and this was a tremendously important moment, I think, in America's relationship to authors and how they present themselves. I don't know if you had the same kind of education I did, but when I was growing up, you were taught that you should never use the word I.
Sure, the objective reigned. That was very important.
Exactly. You were supposed to be objective, uh-huh. And objective meant that you were supposed to be invisible, not detailed, ungendered, unspecific.
Right.
And that was what we trusted.
And
in
with
those
and
years.
With Didion, you get a writer who basically announces the credentials and tells you the context.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Exactly. There was a tremendous change somewhere in the early 70s, I would say, in which, in order to be trusted, a writer now has to say precisely who they are. If nothing else, their gender, their class, their race, but they have to introduce themselves as a personal presence. And I think that Joan Didion, precisely because she's the kind of person that you say she is, very
sort of
cool, right? It's all the more interesting that she feels that in order to be trusted, she has to tell you some of her personal circumstances. Can I come back to Mary McCarthy a moment? I felt that I didn't give her enough credit. I think she was the first great conscious artist who used memoir to her own literary purposes. I think that Memories of a Catholic Girlhood is one of the great books of the 50s.
Phyllis, to come back to the vocabulary of the kind of scholarship that you do again, what do you mean by the literature of meditation? What is that all about?
There's a category of books, of memoirs, in which the facts of daily life are really very unimportant and the movement of the inner life is very important. I'm thinking, for example, of Anne Morrow Lindbergh's incredibly popular book, Gift from the Sea, mm-hmm. in which she takes shells that she's found on the beach and uses them as the basis of meditation. She presents herself as a woman who is caught up in the frenzy of modern life, who is seeking to restore her equanimity. Who else would I include? I would include Annie Dillard's book, Pilgrim at Tinker Creek. Mm-hmm. These are books, however their authors intended them, that people turn to in great numbers for instruction on how to lead their inner lives.
Phyllis, when we talk about the literature of women's lives, does that mean that every life is worthy of being embodied in some sort of literary expression?
Well, I do believe that it is, yes. I think that every life is worth a book. Now, it's not necessarily going to get a good book because the ability to write a memoir is not as widespread as the material. I think it's important to distinguish between the raw material, the facts, the experiences that people have, and the literary equivalent. They're not the same thing, and not all people are capable of transmuting the raw material of their life into a literary artifact.
Well, now that raises the question, an issue that you bring up in your studies of the literature of women's lives, and that is the worthiness of the so-called collaborator, that is to say, literature that is produced not by a single consciousness, male or female, but works through several consciousnesses. We get editors at work. Are we still talking about high literary expression when we have that kind of collaboration going on? A ghost writer, for example?
It can be. It can be great literary expression on the part of the ghostwriter.
Right.
It can be a very precious, a very special collaboration. Not everybody is capable of collaborating with a writer. I myself made a decision in this book to include co-authored texts because I wanted to expand the range of material that mm-hmm. I could bring into it. And there are many people, for various reasons, who don't have the command of language to write a book about their own experiences.
But that doesn't mean that their lives aren't worth looking at.
Exactly.
Phyllis, how would you characterize, what shall we call it, the current mood, the contemporary landscape when we speak of the literature of women's lives?
There are certain truths that become more, what shall we say, acceptable in every decade. And I think the currently acceptable truth is the importance of the mother.
Not the daddy, but the mommy.
Not the daddy, right? It's the era of the mother, and I think that women's memoirs these days are paying particular attention to the role of the mother in young girls' lives.
Well,
you would think that this was obvious, right? That the mother is obviously important,
sure.
but you have to remember that for many years, under the influence of Freudian theory, the emphasis was all on fathers.
Mm-hmm. Is it necessarily a political kind of thing? Does it take on an ideological or a political baggage because it's gendered, because it's looking at the details of a woman's life?
Yes and no. That is, I don't think it is overtly political. Very few of these books are overtly political.
Uh-huh.
But I think that they have what I would call a political impact, even though they're not themselves about politics. Simply by telling the story of somebody whose story has not been told, you're having a political impact.
Phyllis Rose is an essayist, literary critic, and biographer, a professor of English at Wesleyan University. Her books include Parallel Lives, a study of five Victorian marriages, as well as biographies of Josephine Baker and Virginia Woolf. She is most recently the editor of the Norton Book of Women's Lives. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Major funding for this edition of Soundings came from the Modern Language Association of America, which encourages the teaching and study of languages and literature. Cassette tapes of this discussion are available for $10 postpaid. Our address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 789. That's $10, program number 789. Our address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Next week on Soundings, new fiction from writer Richard Ford. Richard Ford will be here to read from and talk about his latest book, a novel entitled Independence Day. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.